There might be some kind of
hierarchy.
Morning, this is May 29th, 2012, and this is a city council work session. Present today is City Manager Matt Brower, Councilman Jay Musley, Councilman John McLeod, Mayor Kent Gwynn, Councilman Daniel Owen. Councilwoman Mary Sue Rich is absent today, and I am Councilwoman Susie Heimbachel. Our hearts are heavy this morning because we lost over the weekend on Friday evening one of our Ocala Electric employees named Timothy Beard. I'm just going to, for the record, give some information for his services. There will be a viewing Wednesday from 6 to 8 at Hires Baxley Funeral Home on Silver Springs Boulevard. Thursday will be a funeral at 10 a.m. at First Baptist Church with a burial following at Forest Lawn Memorial Garden on Pine Avenue. And we're just going to take a few minutes here for a moment of silence. And we'll begin that now. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to Matt Brower, the city manager. We're doing an FMPA update this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Council President. I am pleased and quite frankly have the honor to introduce Mark McCain, who is the assistant manager for FMPA. Nick Gariello is down with the flu, I understand, this morning, and regrets not being able to be here with us this afternoon, but we're in good hands. We also have with us Bud. But I don't remember your last name.
Boudreaux,
thank you. Bud Boudreaux, who is also with us this afternoon with FMPA. And with that, what I'd like to do is go ahead and turn the time over to Mark and take it from there.
Thank you very much, Matt. Council members, we're pleased to have the opportunity to make a presentation in this workshop today. I pass along the regrets of our general manager and CEO, Nick Gariello, who could not be here today. Please let me assure you, if there was any way he could have been here, he would have been here. He takes this very seriously and loves the opportunity to be out in the communities, speaking with the councils and governing board members of his member cities. But he just wasn't able to travel today. So I'll do the best I can to fill in for him. I'm the assistant general manager for member services, human resources, and public relations at FMPA. So I'm one of the four assistant general managers. That's my background, and today I plan to cover a lot about FMPA, the history, make sure you understand that, talk in particular about the All Requirements Project, of which Ocala is a founding member, and then spend some time talking about the strategic initiatives of FMPA. I'm open for taking any questions as we go throughout the presentation today. I understand that you have the slides there probably on your computers, and there may be copies available for you as well. So please stop me at any point if you want to cover it, if you have a question. And then also, before I'll begin today, on behalf of municipal electric utilities around the state, we send our condolences in the loss of your lineman. It's a tragic reminder that this is a difficult and dangerous business. FMPA, in the simplest of terms, you know, we're a little bit hard to understand, I will say. You know, not everybody has heard of a joint action agency before, and so they really don't have a spot to put that in their brain. It's kind of a new concept to some people. In the simplest of terms, I would say that we're a wholesale power company owned by municipal electric utilities, and our primary purpose is to provide economies of scale in power generation and related services to support community-owned electric utilities. Historically, municipal electric utilities, and I'm going back into the 70s, historically they purchased, many of them purchased all their power needs from their neighboring investor-owned utility. That was the situation for Ocala back in the 70s, where they purchased all their power from what at that time was called Florida Power Corporation, today known as Fryers Energy, of course. There were other utilities like Ocala that purchased wholesale power from their neighboring investor-owned utility. There were some municipal utilities that owned their own generation as well. But back in the 70s, that was a time of rising fuel prices. The predominant fuel for many utilities was oil. And you remember the oil, Arab oil embargo, and how that led to rapidly rising prices. It caused a lot of increases in wholesale power costs. In fact, in many cases, after one proposed increase was filed, before that one was even settled, a second rate increase would be filed on top of that. They called that pancake rate increases back in those days. And many of our cities were frustrated by the feeling that they had no control over their destiny. They had no control over one of their largest expenses in their city. And this was certainly the situation in Ocala. As a matter of fact, one of the council members at that time was one of the leading advocates for creating a joint action agency, Gerald Ergel, who I'm sure you all know. So back in those early days, the cities were looking for alternatives for their wholesale power supply. And they got together and they formed the Florida Municipal Power Agency in 1978. It took an act of the Florida State Legislature allowing cities to join together to create a separate governmental legal entity, which is what FMPA is today. There are 30 municipal electric utilities that are members of FMPA. There's a total of 34 municipal electric utilities in the whole state. They're scattered all the way from the Panhandle all the way down to Key West. So four of the cities are not members of FMPA. And just in case you're curious, those four include some of the larger municipal utilities in the state. One is JEA, formerly known as Jacksonville Electric Authority. They're a very large municipal electric utility. They're big enough that they could build their own power plant if they wanted, so they are not a member of the agency. The city of Tallahassee is not a member of FMPA. And then there are two other newer municipal electric utilities. One is the city of Winter Park in Central Florida, and the other is the Reedy Creek Improvement District, which is a municipal utility that serves Walt Disney World. And both of those are newer municipal utilities, and they are actually prohibited from joining FMPA, because when our enabling legislation was passed in the Florida legislature, the investor-owned utilities were fearful that we might grow over time, and perhaps having FMPA might encourage other cities to consider forming a municipal electric utility. So they wanted to limit the growth to the utilities that were in existence at that time. So they put a date in our enabling legislation that has limited our membership. As an interesting aside note, there was a bill passed in the Florida legislature this year that will make it easier for statewide entities like FMPA to hold their meetings and allow their governing board members to participate using communication technology. And as part of that bill, an amendment was made to the date that I was referring to, and that updated that date, so it'll now allow the cities of Winter Park and Reedy Creek Improvement District to join FMPA if they were interested. So this is a list of the 30 municipal electric utilities that are members of FMPA. We are an organization owned and governed by the cities we serve. I can't stress that enough. In my job, I am often talking to people that are not familiar with FMPA, and invariably they come to me with the perception that FMPA is some type of independent organization in Orlando over which the cities do not have control, and nothing could be further from the truth. It's the exact opposite, as a matter of fact. Our governing board, which we'll talk more about in a moment, consists of representatives from each of our member utilities like yourselves. They provide all the policy guidance for our power supply projects. and we are a not-for-profit organization as well. If I had to sum up FMPA and the value that we bring to municipal utilities in the fewest possible number of words, it would be community power, statewide strength. Our role as FMPA is to help municipal electric utilities come together for the common good so that they can pool their collective physical, financial, intellectual resources to enhance their competitiveness. While most municipal customers of municipal electric utilities do not know that FMPA exists, the agency does play a very active role in the wholesale power market, bringing competition to that aspect of our business. By pairing the strengths of a local community-owned utility like Ocala Utility Services with the strength of a statewide organization like FMPA, we like to say that we offer our members the best of community power and statewide strength. From a community power perspective, I'm talking about the advantages you offer your customers of things like local service reliability, not-for-profit operations, local decision-making, and the personal touch, I would say, of a hometown utility. Meanwhile, a statewide organization like FMPA brings economies of scale, access to resources, and strength in numbers. And I hope in my presentation today I'll show a variety of things that we're doing that pay off those values. This personal service, I think, of a local municipal utility backed by the statewide resources of an agency like FMPA is the value proposition that we bring to your city. FMPA was formed primarily for creating economies of scale in power generation. You know, each of our cities has the authority to build and operate their own generating unit. But what our cities discovered many years ago, that if they work together, they can build a larger, more efficient power plant, and they can diversify their power supply resources. And that diversity can come in a couple different ways. You can diversify having ownership interests in a number of different types of generating units. You can have some coal-fired generation. You can have some nuclear-fired. You can have some natural gas-fired generation. You can have some renewable resources. You can also have diversity in the different power plants so that not all of your power comes from a single power plant, such that if that power plant went out of service for some reason, that you had too many eggs in one basket. So through a joint action agency, we enable our cities to diversify their resources and sources. We understand that in many of our member cities, purchase power makes up a significant share of their total expenses. I imagine the Florida Municipal Power Agency is one of the largest bills the city of Ocala pays. So I think it's tremendous that you've given us the opportunity to be here today to spend some time talking about this organization that has a big impact on your operations. The All Requirements Project, which is one of our power supply projects we'll talk a little bit more about in a moment that the city of Ocala is in, it does have a fairly diversified power supply sources, as we'll see. We get power from a number of different generating units. And those combined with some power purchase agreements, which we'll talk a little bit more, is primarily how we supply power to the city of Ocala and the other cities in the All Requirements Project. So that's kind of an overview, I guess, of FMPA. And I'll delve into our power supply projects next, unless somebody has some questions so far. All right, let's take a look at our project-oriented structure. The way FMPA was created by its members decided that they wanted to have what they called a project-oriented agency. That is, any two or more cities who are interested and working together on a power supply project, they could form their own project to have an ownership interest in a power generating unit. And this version of an organization chart tries to give you a picture of our different power supply projects. We supply all the power needs of 14 municipal electric utilities, including Ocala, and that's included in the All Requirements Project, the second block from the right. And you can see underneath the All Requirements Project, we have ownership interests in a number of different power plants. You see there, Stanton, reading from the left, we have Stanton Unit 1, we have some Indian River CTs, that stands for combustion turbines. We have the Kane Island units 1, 2, 3, and 4. We have some generating units down in Key West. We have an ownership interest in Stanton Unit 2, which is a coal fire generating facility, an ownership interest in Stanton A, which is a natural gas fire generating unit, and the project wholly owns the Treasure Coast Energy Center. So those are just a sample of some of the power supply resources that we have in order to serve the power needs of Ocala and the other cities.
Mark, I might just chime in just for a moment. You don't see Crystal River 3 on here, and the reason you don't is it's what's called an excluded resource, meaning that the city owns it outside of the FMPA framework. We're a minority owner of it, own about 2% of it, but it's not part of the FMPA portfolio of projects.
It's us, the city of
it's
Ocala,
us.
Not through
Correct.
FMPA.
Right. Yeah, that's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. When the cities were offered an ownership interest in Crystal River Unit 3, which is the unit that's owned by Progress Energy, at that time FMPA was not in existence. So each of the cities, including Ocala, looked at having an ownership interest, and each of the cities on their own purchased an ownership interest in that unit. And I'm told that it was coming out of that experience that the city said, there ought to be a better way to do this. Instead of each of us doing our own individual power supply studies to see whether or not it's a good deal to get into this or not, and with each of us having to hire our own bond councils and issue our bonds to finance the ownership interest, couldn't we do that collectively as a group and save money? And so it was kind of out of the Crystal River three ownership experience that was an idea to create a joint action agency. And there are this was a movement that was happening around the United States. There are joint action agencies like FMPA in virtually every state that do the same kind of thing for municipal electric utilities. And rural electric cooperatives too saw the value of working together for wholesale power supply, and they created an organization analogous to FMPA, which you probably all know is the Seminole Electric Cooperative. So in addition to the All Requirements Project, that actually, the All Requirements Project was not the very first project. The very first project is the one on the left. That's the St. Lucie Project. It's a nuclear unit owned by Florida Power and Light. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And then following that, we had the opportunity to participate in the Stanton Coal Fire Generating Unit in Orlando. So we created the Stanton Project that has an ownership interest in Unit 1 at the Stanton Energy Center. And then a little bit after that, Orlando Utilities, which owns Stanton Unit 1, said we have a little bit more capacity out of that coal, Stanton Unit 1 coal unit. Do any of your cities, are they interested in purchasing more? And so three of our cities created the Tri-City Project, which also has an ownership interest in Stanton Unit 1. And then came the All Requirements Project, which we'll talk a lot more about today. And then after that, OUC decided to build a second unit at the second coal unit at the Stanton Energy Center. They offered us an ownership interest in that, and a number of cities came together and formed that project. Now that you have a picture of kind of our project-oriented structure, I want to give you a picture of our governance structure, which is also very important to understanding our organization. We have two primary governing boards. One is called the Board of Directors, and the other we call the All Requirements Project Executive Committee, or you may hear me refer to it as ARP Executive Committee. The Let's talk about the ARP Executive Committee first. That's easier to define. That board is responsible for making all governance decisions related to the All Requirements Project. That's the project the City of Ocala is in with 13 other cities that supplies all of the power needs for those cities. So all decisions related to the All Requirements Project are handled through the ARP Executive Committee. And on that executive committee, each of the cities that purchase power from FMPA through that project are enabled to have one representative on the executive committee. And each of the cities appoints their own representative, whoever they'd like that to be. And on that governing board, each city has an equal vote, one person, one vote. Those were all governance decisions that were made by the cities themselves. We also have a separate governing board that we call the Board of Directors. And the Board of Directors, they make policy decisions for all of FMPA's other power supply projects, all the other projects other than All Requirements. So you can see under the Board of Directors, they're responsible for the Stanton Project, the Tri-City Project, Stanton 2, and the St. Lucie Project. On the Board of Directors, there is a weighted vote. And the weighted vote is meant to capture the city's participation in FMPA. So cities on the Board of Directors that are participants in the All Requirements Project, they get two votes. So Ocala gets two votes on the Board of Directors. Any city that is involved in one of the other power supply projects other than All Requirements, those cities get 1.5 votes. And if a city is not in a power supply project, and there are, let's see, how many of those? There are six of those, they get one vote. So there's a weighted vote at the board level. Underneath the Board of Directors, we have some advisory and standing committees, typical committees like the Nominating Committee that is made up of members to make nominations for officers. The Business Planning and Budget Committee, the Audit and Risk Oversight Committee, a very active committee for the All Requirements Project that handles risk matters related to that project. The Member Services Advisory Committee, this is a group of our members that works with us to provide services other than wholesale power supply for our cities. And if we have time today, Bud will talk a little bit more about those. And then on the far right there, we have a relatively new committee, just a few years old, called the Policymaker Liaisons Committee. And the Ocala has a representative on that group. It's Susie Heinbockel. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about that committee, since it's very much focused on policymakers like yourselves. You know, the FMPA realized a couple of years ago that we really it would be beneficial for us to have a closer relationship with the governing board members in our member cities. As I said earlier, we are our city's largest, generally, expense, and I think it's important for the governing boards of those cities to feel like they have some connection to the organization. And it's equally important from FMPA's side to make sure that we have some open lines of communication so that so that we can share information with you, and when you have information that you need to bring to our attention, that you have a way to do that. So we modeled the Policymaker Liaison Committee off of the experience of one of our member cities, Kissimmee Utility Authority. They decided when they joined the All Requirements Project that it was so important to their organization that they wanted to have one of their governing board members attend regularly FMPA meetings. So they appointed one of their board members, and her name was Nancy Gimski, and she faithfully attended FMPA meetings. And we saw what a value that was, how she learned about the organization. It really demystified it quite a bit. You know, if there's an absence of communication, you may have misperceptions about that organization. I talked earlier, you know, that most people, when they don't know us, they think we're some separate autonomous organization over which they have little or no control. But when you come to our board meetings and you sit there and you see your fellow municipal electric utility representatives around the table, they're the governing board members, they're the ones that are struggling with the difficult issues to make policy decisions, I think you get a different perspective on the organization. When we saw that with Nancy Gimsky's participation, and we said, wow, that would be a great model for other cities. So with the approval of the Board of Directors, we created the Policymaker Liaison Committee. Now, that group meets quarterly, and its primary purpose is to open lines of communication between the policymakers and FMPA. I'm proud to say that all of our all requirement cities have a representative on the Policymaker Liaison Committee. And from our perspective, at least, it's been a tremendous success. We really feel like we understand the policymakers' point of view better, and we hope that in the process they've got to know us a little bit better as well.
Mark, before you go on, I'd also like to maybe add that if any of the council members would like to go to an FMPA meeting, please contact me. I know, Jay, you expressed some interest, so we'll make that happen. If you'd also like to maybe attend any of the facilities, Kaylin and Four, the Treasure Coast, let me know. We can also facilitate a trip to those facilities so you can get a familiarity with what FMPA's assets are. I might also add that I'm currently finishing my second term as vice chair of the ARP executive committee. Those votes for the chairmanship and vice chair are taken each year during the summer meetings, during the summer conference, and that takes place into July this year, where there'll be vote on that again. And so the city's been well represented the last 2 years on the executive committee meeting.
Your city is a very active participant on a number of committees, and we appreciate that tremendously. Now that we've talked a little bit about our governance, let's dig a little bit deeper into the power supply projects. I'm going to spend most of the time talking about our requirements, but let me just briefly hit the other power supply projects so you have a feel for those as well. As I mentioned, the first one we created was the St. Lucie project. This is a nuclear power plant primarily owned and operated by Florida Power and Light. It's on the east coast of Florida on Hutchinson Island. FMPA's cities have an 8.8% ownership interest in this unit. It's a 838-megawatt generating facility. It's been in operation since the early 80s, and there are 15 of our cities that are participants in that project. The city is actually, I think it's important to note, had to sue Florida Power and Light in order to get the right to participate in this project. And that suit predates FMPA. The city's Florida Power and Light was proposing, they had already built a couple nuclear units in Turkey Point, and they were planning to build two more units at St. Lucie. And the cities had expressed an interest in participating in those units, but that request was denied. And so the cities in Florida sued Florida Power and Light at the what became known as the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It was the Atomic Energy Agency at that time. And there were similar suits in other parts of the country as well, where municipal utilities were trying to have access to, you know, the new commercially available nuclear power, which was coming on in this country in the mid to late 70s. And we won that, the members won that suit. And when they won, they said, well, let's turn that over to FMPA, which in the interim, while that lawsuit was going on, the cities had formed FMPA. And so that became the agency's first power supply project. The second unit, the second power supply project is the Stanton Energy Center. It's a coal-fired generating unit. Today it has two coal-fired units there and a couple natural gas-fired units as well. The Stanton project is an ownership interest in the first unit at the Stanton Energy Center. It's a 14.8% ownership interest in that coal-fired unit, which generates about 425 megawatts. Six of our members participate in that project. And then, as I mentioned, before that unit was online, Orlando Utilities Commission found themselves with some additional generation available out of that first unit. So three of our other cities stepped up, and they together purchased a 5.3% ownership interest in Stanton Unit 1. And then a couple years later, OUC proposed to build a second coal-fired unit at that site, so we created the Stanton 2 project, we call it, and that project has a 23.2% ownership interest in that second unit at Stanton. And both of those coal units have been exceptional investments. They've run very well. The Stanton Unit 2 is one of the cleanest coal-fired plants in the country. It's been excellent. Likewise, the St. Lucie nuclear plant has been a very good investment for the cities as well. It's been a reliable generating unit for our cities. It's great to have some nuclear capacity in your generation portfolio. You know, nuclear units generally, it would be very difficult for a municipal utility, I got to say, to, you know, build a nuclear unit. I mean, it could happen in, for some very, very large municipal utilities, but it's very fortuitous that the cities saw the value of joint participation and were able to get the opportunity to participate in nuclear as well. These are all long-term investments, and I will say from the start, you know, there are sometimes where these projects have been in the money. You know, they've been the lowest cost resource available. And then over time, as things change, there are sometimes when they are not the lowest cost resource. You know, I would liken it just to investing, you know, and thinking about that. There are sometimes that equities are the way to go, and there are other years that bonds are the place to be. And it doesn't, and it changes over time. And I hope throughout this presentation, one of the things that I can impart is the importance of diversity, because things change over time in our industry. Sometimes you're in the money, sometimes you're out of the money, but if you have diversity in your fuel supply, diversity in your power generation resources, just like you generally like diversity in your investments, it smooths out the performance over a period of time. Now we'll focus in a little bit more on the All Requirements Project, which is what I'm here primarily to talk about. You know, that project supplies all the power needs for 14 cities. It, far and away, is FMPA's largest power supply project. Is probably more than 80% of the revenues and expenses of the agency. And this is the project that Ocala is one of the founding members of. There are 14 cities, as you can see on the map here. They're located all over the state of Florida, from the Panhandle all the way down to Key West. Those are the 14 cities listed on that chart, and we'll talk a little bit more about all requirements. To understand all requirements, it's important to know its beginnings and its origins. So I want to spend a few moments on expanding on what I was talking about earlier. You know, it was back in the late 70s, as I mentioned earlier, where, you know, there was rapidly rising wholesale costs. The investor-owned utilities, as I mentioned, were filing one rate increase after another, and the cities felt that they had no control over their destiny. And so they wanted to work together to see if they could create a wholesale power supplier that would be an alternative to the investor-owned utilities. And they wanted to work together to leverage economies of scale and primarily to take control of their destiny, I think, is what I heard from the founding members. They did an economic feasibility study back in the day to see if it would be cost-effective for our cities to do that. That study was very conservative. Nick Goriello, our general manager and CEO, he worked for a consulting engineering firm at the time, known as R.W. Beck. R.W. Beck did that economic feasibility study. And it showed maybe that the cities would only save about 1%. So the city's decision to create All Requirements Project, it really wasn't founded on savings estimates. Although they hoped and they believed that those numbers were conservative and over time the project would prove to save its city's money, that was not their primary motivation. And I'll just read a quote from Gerald Ergel, who, you know, was a former mayor of the city of Ocala. And he said this in a speech in 1997 at the FMPA annual conference. He said, quote, "We knew the savings estimates were conservative, and we factored that into our decision. But more than savings or anything else, We were frustrated by a lack of control over a major part of our destiny and frustrated by Florida Power Corporation's, now known as Progress Energy Florida, emphasis on short-term results at the expense of our long-term mutual prosperity. We knew that with FMPA, we'd have control and the agency would have our best interests at heart. And so it was with that kind of sentiment that the cities formed the All Requirements Project in 1986. There were five original members, all non-generating cities, and Ocala was one of the founding members. As it turned out, the project was wildly successful and tremendously cost-effective, and just delighted and surprised everybody with the savings that it produced. In those early years, the original five cities, they saved, within the first 5 months, they saved 19% over what they would have paid with their previous power supplier. And those lower costs continued for a number of years. On average, I would say the cities back in those days, I think, were probably saving 15% less than they would have paid with their previous power suppliers, and that was amounting to hundreds of millions of dollars for those cities. As we were traveling around, making presentations to our member cities, seeing if they would be interested in joining the All Requirements Project, the investor-owned utilities wanted to maintain their customers, and so they made an offer to the cities. They said, if you'll stay with us, Florida Power Corporation at that time said, if you'll stay with us, we will match FMPA's rates. If FMPA's rates are lower, we'll refund that money to you. And so several cities did accept Florida Power's rate matching offer. And that rate matching offer was in effect from 86 through 1998. And those cities that signed up for that, they saved $34.2 million. So it was very, very successful. Right from the beginning, the cities that joined All Requirements, they decided that they were going to have ownership interests in power plants, but that they were also going to purchase power as well. That's always an option for us. And this slide shows you today our capacity resources divided by type. Anytime, you know, we're looking ahead and see a need for additional generating capacity to serve our members' future power supply needs, you know, generally we look at what's our best option, self-build option, we call it. What could we build? How much would that cost? And then with that information, we go out to the market and we say, is there anybody in the market that's willing to sell us power? And we compare those power supply proposals against our self-build option and to see what is the most economical decision for our member cities. And it's our member cities, the governing boards, that decide whether they want to build a unit or whether they want to enter into a contract power purchase. And so today, we find ourselves with a mixture of ownership interest in power plants and also power purchases. And this chart shows that for you. The first line there is nuclear capacity. As Matt mentioned earlier, those are excluded resources. The member cities, back in the early days of the project, nuclear power was touted as too cheap to meter. But some cities were also not interested in having ownership interest in nuclear power because of the risks inherent in that. And so the cities decided that they would, those that had ownership interests in nuclear units, whether they were direct ownership interests in Crystal River Unit 3, or whether it was an entitlement share through FMPA's St. Lucie project, that they would make those excluded resources, which means the cities like Ocala would directly receive their Crystal River 3 entitlement, and then All Requirements Project would supply the power needed on top of that to meet your peak demand. So nuclear units are excluded resources. We have 77 total megawatts among our 14 cities, and that makes up about 4% of our generating capacity. That second category there called ARP ownership, that stands for All Requirements Project Ownership. Those are units that we have direct ownership interests in, and that accounts for about 60% of our available capacity today. That includes units like the Treasure Coast Energy Center, which the All Requirements Project owns outright. It owns the whole unit as well as some other wholly owned units like some combustion turbine units in Key West and a natural gas fired unit called Cane Island Unit 4 in Osceola County. This category also includes some units that we have minority ownership shares in, things like Stanton Unit 1, Stanton Unit 2, Indian River combustion turbine units, Cane Island Units 1, 2, and 3, and then an ownership in a unit primarily owned and operated by Southern Company. The third category, ARP participant-owned generation. Over the years, the All Requirements Project grew, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. And some of the cities that joined the project were what we call generating cities, cities that had their own generating resources. And so they brought those into the project as well. And those account for about 405 megawatts, which is about 21% of our current capacity. And then we also have power purchase agreements that account for about 15% of our capacity today. And those are power purchase contracts with Florida Power and Light and Southern Company. You know, there was a time when our power purchases were a larger percent of our total capacity, where there was more of a buyer's market where we could, it was cheaper for us to buy than to build. There was a period there in the 90s where the power market was tighter and there weren't as many cost-effective power purchase opportunities. And it was in that period of time that we built more of our generating units. And so now we find ourselves with more ownership than purchases, but that can change over time.
Matt, just a quick question. At what time did we become more of a, in the generating business instead of, you know, buying like we were talking about, like power purchase? I mean, in the beginning, was FMPA, you know, kind of formed so that we could all buy power cheaper together than we could individually, and then we kind of started getting in the generating business? Is that kind of...
Right, yeah. You know, FMPA was formed, so that cities could work together and create economies of scale, not right. only in building generation, but also buying as
right.
well.
Okay.
And in the early days, we were primarily minority owners in power plants operated by others. Plus, at that time, the investor-owned utilities also had a type of wholesale power supply called partial requirements service. It was pretty economical. And so we bought a lot of power through the investor-owned utilities, through partial requirements. Over time, they raised the price of partial requirements. And it seemed to me, particularly Florida Power and Light, made an effort to exit that business. And it wasn't as economical for us to buy power. Also in the, I would say, late 80s or early 90s, they really made some technological advances in natural gas-fired generating right. units. And up until that point, the most efficient units to build were coal and nuclear. And we're too small to build our own coal and nuclear unit, and particularly were at the time, back in the 70s and 80s. But these new natural gas-fired generating units, this new technology was smaller. It was a size that was appropriate for a utility our size. They were easier to build, they had less environmental impact, natural gas prices were really cheap at that time, $2 per million BTU, and that price had been steady for some time. So that change in our business really was what, in my view, drove us, made our members see that it was more economical for them to build a unit than to buy.
Okay.
I might also add in our most recent project, the Cane Island 4 project, located down in Kissimmee. That project went under construction probably 2009, 2010. At that time, with the precipitous growth in the state, there was just no additional capacity available to enter into a power purchase agreement, leaving FMPA with really the only avenue at that time, which was to self-build. And that's why they decided to go ahead and build the Cane Island 4 generating plant.
And I just want to emphasize again, that's a decision that's made by our governing board members. The staff does the analysis, we bring the options to our members, and so our members have all the information there to make that choice. Just a couple of slides I'll step through very quickly, just make the point that FMPA is a wholesale power supplier, so we do the traditional roles of a wholesale power supplier are the planning for the future power supply needs, developing projects, whether it's an ownership interest or whether we're going to build a generating unit, financing the ownership interest for our members if that's what they decide to do, and then once the units are in operation, you know, optimizing the operation of those generating resources to supply power at the lowest possible cost. The city of Ocala then is responsible for everything at the distribution level. The city of Ocala is responsible for operating the distribution system. They are responsible for setting rates. FMPA has no influence over that. The city does billing to customers, and our responsibility is to deliver the wholesale power to the city gate, and then from that point, the city takes it and manages all the aspects of the retail operation. The All Requirements Project, when it was created, the members agreed from the beginning that they were interested in planning for their long-term power supply needs, and that, in their mind, meant purchases as well as ownership interest. And so let me talk a little bit about the contract and why it is the way it is. The city is knowing that they might be interested in purchasing generating units, knew that they would be financing those with tax-exempt municipal bonds. And generally, those are long-lived assets, 25 to 35 years. And in order to borrow money to finance those resources, they would have to have long-term contracts so that when FMPA went to the bond market, that we had contracts for the life of those facilities. And so the city's decided to create a contract with a 30-year term. And knowing over time that a few years down the road they might have a need to build another generating unit, the city's decided that they would make the contract what they called an evergreen contract. So every year it automatically adds another year to the contract unless the city submits notice to stop the automatic renewal. That way in the future we always have a 30-year contract if we want to build a new unit like Cane Island Unit 4. We have a 30-year contract in place so that we can issue bonds on that facility.
If I can just dwell here for just a moment, this is significant. There's been a number of cities, Fort Meade, Vero Beach, and perhaps even some others who I can't recall right now, who have expressed some reservations with having a 30-year contract. In the industry, they're kind of referred to as an ironclad contract, and they're written that way purposely. As Mark indicated, they're to protect the bondholders. These contracts, of course, are to extend beyond the life of an issuance of a bond. But even more importantly, in my opinion, is it protects the cities, including Ocala, from having another city say, you know, we've got to have as much fun as we possibly can, we're out, and you guys are left holding the bag for all of our liabilities and assets. And so it's really a tool to protect those cities which are truly committed to the project by ensuring that other cities just simply can't walk away from their obligations, leaving us on the hook for all the debt service. And so from those two perspectives, it's really important to have an ironclad contract.
Yes, Matt is exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. The cities, that's exactly what they talked about when they created the project, that they wanted to protect cities that remained in the project. And so now today we have one city who's no longer in the All Requirements Project, the city of Vero Beach, but they are in other power supply projects of FMPA, and those other contracts are long-term agreements like All Requirements. And you know, the city of Vero Beach wants to exit its partnership with those other cities, but they need to live up to the terms of the contract, which protect the cities that remain in that project, so that they're not financially hurt by one of the cities leaving. These are our principal collateral that supports repayment of our bonds, and So the sanctity of these contracts is vitally important. In those early years in the All Requirements Project, I mentioned that, you know, the savings were tremendous, 15%. Boy, those were great meetings. We'd meet every month and we would talk about the savings estimates and people around the table. It was just big money and everybody was very pleased. And there were other cities that said, hey, let me into that project. I'm interested. These were, many of them were generating cities that wanted to join non-generators like Ocala. And so we did a study called the Integrated Dispatch and Operations of how we might bring generating units into the project. And in order to do that, we needed a special type of transmission service from the investor-owned utilities, a type of transmission service that they use themselves, but a type of service that up until that point they didn't offer to others, a type of service that became known as network transmission service. And we asked for that service, and they refused to provide service, so the cities filed an antitrust suit against Florida Power and Light. And after a number of years, the cities won that lawsuit, and Florida Power and Light was ordered to provide network transmission service to the Florida cities. That was a monumental achievement. I mean, it truly was a precedent-setting decision, not just in Florida, but around the nation. It meant that network service had to be made available to municipal electric utilities all around the country. And so with winning that transmission service, we were able to bring in other cities, and the All Requirements Project grew over the years. As I mentioned, there originally were five cities when the project was created in 1986, and it grew to 10 by 1999, and today we have 14 cities with a combined peak demand of about 1,400 megawatts. The growth during the 90s occurred at a challenging time for us as well. You know, in the early years, natural gas was very stably priced and very low, and we were very competitive. In the 90s, natural gas-fired generating units were the thing to do, not just for FMPA, but all kinds of utilities were investing in natural gas units. And we were, and still are today, very largely dependent on natural gas as our primary fuel for most of our most cost-effective generating resources. And in the 90s, the price of natural gas became much more volatile, and we're going to cover that in more detail. And so there has been a period of time here recently when FMPA was not competitive. We're going to talk a lot about that in just a few minutes and what we're doing to return to competitiveness. And I have some good information to share with you on that front today, too. I think finally in the past 2 years, we see the fruits of our labors. And when I say our, I'm not just talking about the staff. I'm talking about our members who have worked diligently over the past couple of years. I mean, really got together in a tremendous way. You know, they've come together in ways we probably haven't seen since the project was formed back in the 80s to work hard to analyze the business and make decisions to return us to competitiveness. And it's, I'm happy to say, it's starting to pay off. Some of that is because natural gas prices have come back down, and we're thankful for that, but there's other things our cities are doing as well, and we'll cover those. You know, we lived through some difficult times in 2008 and 2009, and our city said we need to have a new strategic plan, and they got together in February of 2009. They spent a day and a half, and they developed a new strategic plan for the organization, and we have been working diligently on that plan ever since. Our member cities, just this February, they decided they want to update their plan again, and they plan to do that probably in the fall of this year. But right now we're operating under this strategic plan. I'll just tell you briefly you know, about it. The members decided that their vision for FMPA is to be the preferred power service provider for municipal electric utilities and the company of choice for its employees. And their number one strategic goal is to return FMPA to rate competitiveness and a lot that we have been working on in the past several years has been focused on that number one goal. That's not our only goal. There are five goals in our strategic plan, but certainly lowering wholesale power costs is our number one goal. We've identified several strategies that we're employing to lower our wholesale power cost. One of the primary things I would say that we have done is, at the encouraging of our members, we created what's called the All Requirements Project Business Model Working Group, or, you know, everything has an acronym in our business, so we call it the BMWG. That group has met more than 20 times in the past couple of years, and the purpose of that group is kind of in a workshop format, I guess like you have here today, to really delve into issues. They pick a topic that they want to know more about, delve into it, learn as much about it as they can, and with that information they decide, do we need to do anything different to change our business model? Do we want to make any decisions as a result of this, or are we happy with the information we have here? Don't see any need to make any changes, and we move on to another topic. That's been a very, very productive effort, and we're pleased that Ocala has been well represented on that business model working group. One of our strategies in this area is to measure, understand, and manage our risk. We have really grown our risk management practices at FMPA, primarily related to managing our fuel cost risk, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We've also looked at ways to diversify our power generating resources. As I mentioned, we're very dependent on natural gas. We're continuing to look at options and alternatives for diversifying our power supply resources. We haven't entered into any opportunities yet, but we'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing in that area. You know, I think we're finally seeing that we're turning a corner. We just did a member relations survey at FMPA. We do this every 2 years, and the results, which will be released next month, are very encouraging. Our members, our satisfaction is now at an all-time high. It's never been higher since we started doing the survey in 2000. And we ask a question generally, do our members feel that we're headed in the right direction? And virtually everybody said yes. So I think this strategic planning effort has been critical to our organization and the way it's brought our members together. And I think now the fruits of their labors that we're all seeing is starting to pay off. We still have lots of important work that we have to do, and that will never end, really. My good news today is that we're making progress. If you have a perception of FMPA from a couple years ago as being one of the highest cost power suppliers in the state, I would encourage you to take a look at some more information I'm going to be sharing with you today, and you'll see that was then, but it's a different story today. I mentioned that FMPA and our All Requirements Project is looking at some opportunities to diversify our power supply resources. With the downturn in the economy, we find ourselves not needing to add new generating units probably until 2021, if things stay the way they are right now. Of course, we look at that every year, seeing if things are changing. But nonetheless, we're always looking at opportunities out there, and this downturn in the economy has created a situation where there are other utilities that also find themselves with what we sometimes refer to as excess capacity. And those other utilities are looking at perhaps selling some of their existing generating capacity. And so there are some utilities that have some existing nuclear units north of the border, I'll say, they're in the southeast United States, that are interested in selling some generating capacity from those units. We're taking a look at those opportunities. And you'll say, but Mark, you just said that you don't need generation until 2021. Yes, that's true, but we also think that it's part of our job to continue to look at options for you and present that information to you and see if you want to make a strategic decision. If it's not a decision made solely on cost effectiveness, maybe it's a decision you'd want to make because it helps diversify your power supply resources. So we're looking at those. The city of Vero Beach, as was mentioned, is interested in perhaps selling their utility, municipal utility, to Florida Power and Light. In order to do so, they would have to, the city would have to exit its existing power contracts with FMPA. That includes entitlement shares the city of Vero Beach has through three projects, the St. Lucie, Stanton, and Stanton 2 projects. And so the city has issued a intent to sell those assets, and we're looking at that for our requirement cities to see if that would be an economical opportunity for them. The city of Vero Beach just came and met with Nick and some others here recently, and so we're going to begin that evaluation process for the All Requirements project. The city of Vero Beach also asked us to take a look at our other FMPA member cities, contact them, and see if any of those cities might be interested in taking over those entitlement shares as well. So that's an ongoing activity.
I mean, what happens with if they go out? Do we absorb all their debt, or how does that work? Are they talking about getting out of FMPA? Are they in the R requirements?
No, not
they
more.
Are not. Okay.
They were.
Technically they are, but they under the terms of the contract, they're not required to purchase any power from all requirements.
Okay.
They are looking to have someone buy their entitlements.
Okay.
They are obligated through those agreements we talked about to comply with the agreement unless they can find someone to buy those entitlements. But even when they find someone to buy those entitlements, at the end of the day, they're still responsible to FMPA for their share of the obligations.
Absolutely. How would that affect us, the rest of us?
If we were interested in buying their entitlements because we need additional capacity,
right,
we could look at that as an opportunity. I think staff is doing that. As Mark indicated, we don't need additional capacity until about 2021. And so we're constantly monitoring, evaluating what's out there. And I don't think staff's rendered any decision as of yet.
No. Yeah, these are, you know, good resources that are in Florida. We have a great operating history of them. You know, it's worth taking a look at them to see if these would be good additions to the All Requirements Project's portfolio of resources. But we got to weigh that against the factor that we don't really need them right now. And so can we delay taking the resources for a couple of years? And how would that impact, you know, the economics? So we're going to look at, you know, a number of options and present that information to our member cities for their decision.
Okay.
You know, we've been contacted by some utilities north of the border who have some existing coal-fired generating capacity that they're interested in selling. And so, you know, we're taking a look at that as well. It's always good to investigate them and gather information to help make your decisions. We're often contacted by renewable energy providers as well. And, you know, we're interested in perhaps diversifying our generation and taking on more renewable resources as well. And there may be a standard required by either the state or federal government that a portion of our power generation come from renewables. So we take a look at those. And, you know, we've looked in the past at a renewable project here in Ocala that would use manure from horses to fuel generation. We haven't heard anything from them in at least 2 years.
Is that Dr. Cervantes?
No, it's the company is out of Texas, and they're working
with the OBS?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we've also looked at, we're looking at a waste energy facility in Leesburg that's approached us, and then a landfill gas project that's being proposed near Stark. So we take a look at those opportunities as they come along as well. That kind of lays the groundwork in my mind for the All Requirements Project. I'd like to spend a little bit more time talking about fuel, which has been the source of some of our challenges in recent years. I want you to understand what happened and what we're doing about that. But I guess I'll pause to see if there are any other questions before I move on. Are we doing okay on time?
Probably about 15 more minutes.
Okay. This is a chart of natural gas prices from January 2000 till July 2011. You know, prior to 2000, natural gas prices had been very stable, around $2 per million BTU. But since 2000, they've been anything but stable. And you can see the prices here have some dramatic peaks. You know, going up 200, 300, 500% from a low to a high. You know, so my purpose of this graph is just to show you how volatile natural gas prices have been. Now, you can see the good news over on the very right is that natural gas prices have kind of returned near their long-term average. But in between, it created a lot of difficulty for our project. And it has been a real challenge for us.
If I can just dwell here for a moment, this is important to understand. If you look at the summer of 2008, you had some volatility there. Gas prices increased in excess of 500%. There are really two things that happened in Ocala to result in our electric rates becoming highest in the state. One was the volatility in the fuel market. What happened there was, as prices started going up, FMPA began hedging. I think they started their hedging around the $10. And at that time, it felt like they dodged a bullet because prices continued to go up to $11, $12, $13, almost $14. But as you know, since then, the prices have precipitously dropped and stayed around approximately the $2 to $3 per MMBTU mark. Compounding that summer of 2008 issue was that staff brought forward a recommendation to make up an under-collection in the two highest usage months of the year, August and September, wanting to make that up before the end of the fiscal year. And so compounding the natural gas volatility with staff trying to make up an under-collected position in the two highest usage months of the year, and voila, you have the highest rates in the state of Florida. And I think Mark's going to talk about in a minute some of the things that we've done at FMPA to make sure that we don't hedge at that volume. I can also state that the city has also changed our process in the way we evaluate recommendations for rate increases. No longer is it a unilateral decision. It's got to go through a committee that has Karen White, Larry Novak, myself, John Leggy, that we evaluate the changes in the necessary rates so that we have a group looking at it. We also seek the assistance of FMPA to make sure that we got our ducks in a row. And so we put a number of things in place to make sure that we do not repeat what happened in the summer of 2008.
Yeah, because it looks like the price was, you know, higher in January through April of 2006, but we didn't have the, you know, big rate increase, I guess, mm-hmm. Partly because of the recommendation the staff made.
Partly, and I think at that time FMPA had some rate stabilization fund monies available, I believe, is that correct?
Before
in 2005, 2006, do you recall?
We did have some money one time. I was thinking, though, that it was even before that.
Yeah. In that case, the issue wasn't compounded by a staff recommendation to increase the rates to make up under collection.
And let me ask you a question. When you talk about like $4 per, what do you, is it, how is that measured? It's
MMBTUs
BTU,
per million British thermal units.
Right. See, and this is important because 70% of our mix is natural gas. Right. So the market has volatility in it. It's important that we have the appropriate tools in place to make sure that we're not, impacted negatively by the volatility.
My question is, if the hedging was in 08, it done at $10, why would we not hedge now at the price it's at, because even if it dropped completely out of bed, you're not going that far.
Right.
But just looking at commodities charts, not just this particular chart, but all commodities charts, if you see this and we're at this, it's just a matter of time before it goes there.
Right.
I can speak to that because it's a policy issue.
One of the
reasons, quite frankly, is the executive committee, quite frankly, has a lot of doubts about financial hedges as a result of what happened in 2008. We've drastically scaled back our hedging policy, our financial hedging policy. In 2008, the FMPA could hedge up to 100% for 3 years. Is that correct?
2 years.
2 years.
Yes.
Now it's been changed so that the FMPA can only hedge a maximum of 75% up to 4 months. And so we've scaled back our ability to financial hedge significantly. We have, in addition to do financial hedges, we've also got physical hedges in place for actually buying natural gas and storing it, to be able to use it when gas prices are higher. But there's a great reluctance on the part of the board to have a more robust financial hedging policy at this time.
Well, and I understand that, but it's easy to be overly safe, you know, once you've been burned at $10. But we're talking about hedging when we're at, what, $4?
Right now,
yeah.
About $2? Yeah.
It's like you overcorrected yourself and you're not willing to play the game anymore. And you know from looking at any commodities chart, when you've got those double tops like that and drops out of bed, it's just a matter of time before it goes through the roof again.
Right.
And, you know, it just seems to me there's been an overcorrection in that philosophy.
The idea behind the short-term financial hedge policy of FMPA is that what it would do, what it's geared to do, is it would allow us to shave off a peak. If you go back to 2008,
mm-hmm.
because it's 4 months, it would allow us to shave off that peak and participate on the downside of that market.
Mm-hmm. We'd
be able to float back down with it because the hedges only be 4 months in length.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the earlier policy, we were locked in for 2 years. In fact, we're still just now rolling out of some of the hedge positions that we had. And so the idea is we can cut off the peaks and we can also float on the downside of the market should that happen. Well, my personal position is at FMPA, and I think my staff shares this, is we've got to have a toolbox. I keep using that metaphor, toolbox. It's got to be financial hedges. It's got to be physical hedges. It's got to be rate stabilization fund. It's got to be tracking the market a little bit. It can't be just one thing. It's got to be a lot of stuff. In fact, I can also tell you that the city of Ocala now has been able to develop about $32 million in a rate stabilization fund that would allow us to leverage that fund to avoid that scenario should it happen again in the future, to help keep the smoothness in the rates.
Well, and I agree with all of those. I'm just saying that if it's at $2 now and we hedge it out for the next 3 years, you're talking about a rate stabilization fund, and it's stable for the next 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, and I don't know. It seems like it's an overreaction to a mistake made at $10.
Ocala's position is to have a longer financial hedge program.
Mm-hmm.
That's our position, remains our position. But there are many on that board who have opposite opinions.
Well, sure, they got burnt. But,
yep.
I mean, it doesn't mean you still shouldn't play the game.
Yeah. The way those markets operate, even if gas today is trading at $2.50, you can't buy it at $2.50 out for 3 years. You know, they have a forward price curve, they say, and so, you know, it generally gets more expensive the further out you want to go.
Sure.
And I think a number of our cities have been hesitant to commit to pay more than what might be the market price.
So in 08, when we hedged the market at 10, we were actually hedging on the third year at a higher rate than we were in 08. Is that correct? Those contracts?
Yes. Right.
Still doesn't change my argument. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but
well, you make complete sense.
We've had a lot of discussions about that.
At two, whatever it is now, 250 back in October of 2009. I mean, if you hedge there, I mean, you've got nowhere to go but to you know, down, you know, just to free.
Yeah.
So And I know what you're saying about, you know, I guess on the, if you do 3 years out, you know, it's going to be, you know, more expensive. I don't know from 250 to what, 275 or three, how much more expensive it's going to get. But, you know, it's, I guess it's kind of like a variable rate mortgage and a fixed rate mortgage somewhat, you know, with this, you know. But, I mean, we had, in my day job, we had a guy that, you know, back in 19, I was in the banking business back in 1980 in Jimmy Carter days, you know, hedged on some, you know, investments that were fixed for 15% for 20 years. Mm-hmm. Everybody said, you're an idiot. You know, rates are just going to, you know, continue to go up. Why are you, you know, locking it in at 15? Genius. Guy's a genius now, you know. So anyway. I agree with Councilman McLeod. I mean, it, you know, if you're locked in at, you know, 250, and you have nowhere to go but, you know, down.
Yeah, there's a lot more up risk than there is down risk.
Yeah.
And this is what That's we're spending. Our members are spending a lot of time talking about, and I have a few slides in here to share some of what Matt said already. We do have a new hedging program, which we call the FMPA short-term hedging. We can talk about that. They're also discussing another thing they call the Gantt plan, which is an internal hedging program, they call it. And they're looking at a number of different tools, I think is a good metaphor, to try to manage this significant risk in our business.
Right. And that, just one last comment, and I agree with Matt, you have to have a lot of different tools in your toolbox, mm-hmm. but as far as the natural gas piece of it, you know, maybe don't do 75% of your, you know, fuel in that, but that portion that mm-hmm. you are doing in, so it, you know, when you're at that, extending it out for, you know, a number of years.
Yes, staff will continue to champion a longer-term financial hedge program.
Yeah, I just think it's gotten overly conservative because we got burned, and maybe it needs to. I know you guys are looking at it. I'm preaching to the choir, probably, but.
Right. Yeah, we're talking all the time, and you know, we would welcome you to participate in our governing board meetings and share thoughts like that. I mean, it's an issue all of our members are struggling with, trying to find the right answer.
Okay.
I'll step through a couple slides here. You know, this is a lot of math. I'm a journalism major. The important point for those two slides to me is that for every dollar increase in natural gas, it has a multiplied effect in our cost of power. You know, because we're taking a BTU of gas, turning it into electricity, there's a natural loss in creating those two. And so for every dollar increase in gas, the way our portfolio is currently structured, it adds about $5.60 per 1,000 kilowatt hours to the retail cost. So not only is that dramatic chart interesting to see, but for every dollar increase, it has a multiplied effect once it's turned into electricity, and that's why it's so
significant. Let me explain it this way.
Yeah.
Each generating unit has what they call a heat rate. It's a measure of its efficiency. And the K-Line 4, which is one of the best rated units in the country, I understand,
mm-hmm. right.
has a heat rate of about 7 or 8,
yes.
if you recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's right in the 7,500.
What that means in layman's term, is that it takes 8 units of gas to make 1 unit of electricity. So if the gas prices go up $1, that's where the multiplier of 8 comes in at.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. Obviously, it's passed down to our
yes.
right there.
Yeah.
This chart is there to demonstrate that our prior program, which is in kind of the salmon color, was longer in term. It went out 2 years. And it was higher in the amount that we could hedge. We could hedge up to 100% in the month right before we planned to use the gas. Now under the new FMPA short-term program, which we call FST, it's much shorter term. It's only 4 months. We can only hedge a maximum of 75% of our gas needs. And this plan also has a sell strategy to it as well, so that when prices are going up, there's a mechanical trigger that tells us when to buy the hedges, and if the prices fall beyond in a mechanical trigger process, it tells us when to sell the hedges as well. The previous policy we had We did not really have a sell strategy. We had, at several points, we came back to our members and we said, you know, we're, the hedging program is in the money. Do you want to sell any of our positions and make money? And we did not do that. And then when the bottom dropped out of the natural gas market, we did not have a sell strategy for that either. And we as the market went down, we stayed with our higher priced hedges. And that's something that we have corrected with the new strategy now. Now we have a sell strategy. This chart, you know, we describe the new FST Plus program as really being an insurance policy that tries to clip the price spikes. Really, this hedging policy is going to keep our members pretty close to the market price. What you'll see on this chart is that if the red line is the price of natural gas, the green line is the FST results. So, you know, it tracks, the red and green line track pretty closely. Just where you see the benefits is on the spikes, where it just clips the top of that spike a little bit. Limits, so it limits our exposure to the price spikes and allows us to participate in a declining market. Those are the key features of your new hedging strategy.
That's real interesting. And what's the price of the insurance, this FST, if I'm saying that correctly?
Well, yeah, it, you know, I can't quote you an exact price. It depends on what we're purchasing and what the price of the natural gas is at the time.
Yeah, the insurance is more of a metaphor. It's the cost of the hedges,
right?
Whatever they were when we bought them.
Okay.
And I think we've spent, I think, $9 million to date on the FST Plus hedging program.
Great idea.
And what we've actually done is even make the program more conservative. Now, there's two trigger environments that got to happen before we'll actually hedge financially. Originally, it was one, the policy board felt like it was triggering too early, causing us to buy insurance too quickly. They put a second trigger in, and since then, I don't think it's triggered at all.
No, yeah, we don't have any FST positions right now, you're correct.
So the insurance is just a metaphor talking about the cost of the financial hedges.
Okay. Yeah. Good question. Thank you. Matt mentioned that we have a committee. The members have a committee that looks at our hedging policy. We also have a more robust internal staff committee as well. We call the Hedging Rates and Liquidity Committee that internally reviews our hedging program. You know, I have a section on all requirements rates that feed into the city's rates as well. I feel like I probably need to speed through some of these a bit. You know, our wholesale rates are primarily made up of three components: a demand component, energy, and transmission. I always think of the demand as like your car payment. It's you know, what you owe on your car. It's that fixed payment. You know what it's going to be every month. The energy component is the fuel that it costs to operate your car. And the transmission is like what you pay for toll roads, what we pay to deliver the energy from the generating units to the cities. So those are our three primary rate elements in our wholesale rates. So a little bit different than retail rates. This chart is, I know you cannot read it up on the screen. I have handouts that you know, that might be easier to read than what you have in there. I don't know, but. You know, this goes back to January 2010 up till April through this year. When you have a little bit more time, you can take a look at, you know, what FMPA's wholesale rates have been, how they've gone up and down. You can also see the retail rates, Ocala's retail rates, and how they've come down over the years. There's another column on there called load factor, which is important as well. Load factor is an indication of efficiency. If all your customers used energy at their maximum for the entire month, you would have 100% load factor, and that would be tremendous. You would have sold a lot of kilowatt hours to recover your costs. But as we know, the demand for electricity goes up and it goes down. And so every month we compare what you sold that month compared to what the maximum you could have sold for the month. And that percentage is what's called a load factor. And you can, there's a load factor column. It affects your average cost of power. When your load factor is higher, you know, in a month where it, like November of 2010, you know, where the load factor is high at 73%, you see a very low wholesale cost down at $55.
A good example of a load factor is, think of a hotel. Say you've got 100 rooms in a hotel, so you have a 100-room hotel, and you're only selling out 50% of the rooms each night. So your occupancy is only 50%. So you, in this case, you'd have a 50% load factor. It's, you have the ability to sell 100 rooms, but you're only selling 50, and so you're only 50% efficient. It's the same idea.
Yes. And you can see then in some months where we've had a lower load factor, if you look at January or February 2012, the load factor is down in below 50%. Generally in a winter month that occurs because there might be a high peak because of cold weather that comes in for a short period of time, and then the weather returns to more of a typical Florida winter, and that results in a low load factor, and then you can see that has the effect of pushing up the average wholesale cost a bit. That's an important concept, I think, that's good to understand as you realize what kind of effect that can have on varying wholesale costs. And we're a cost-based organization. We, our rates are designed just to recover our costs plus some money for working capital. But our members have set those rates up so that they change monthly, unlike your retail rates, which tend to be a little bit more stable. Ours change monthly because our members wanted the wholesale rate to reflect the current costs. So as you look down that list, you say, oh my gosh, it changes every month, but that's the way the members have wanted to structure their rates. This chart is a nice little summary that shows you that our wholesale costs are coming down. The blue line there was 2009, and overall you can see how much higher that was. It was up at its worst at $130 per 1,000 kilowatt hours. In 2010, kind of that gold colored line, you know, they came down. They're down in 2011 and down. The projections for 2012 look like they might be overall just a little bit lower. That's the monthly rate comparison. If we averaged them, you know, for the year, this is what you'd be seeing in 2009, 10, 11. You can see from 2009 to 2011, our rates have come down 20% in the past 2 years. This is at the wholesale level. And if current natural gas prices hold, it looks like our 2012, you know, will be maybe slightly lower as well. This is on an overall average. You know, the caveat I would have to put in there is that it can vary depending on individual systems, load factors, and experience. But on an average basis, that gives you a good snapshot of where we are compared to where we've been. And this is a snapshot of where the city of Ocala's retail rates are. The red line is city of Ocala, and the blue line is Progress Energy. And you can see now the good news is that Ocala is lower than Progress Energy over on the right.
And this doesn't include the rate decrease, which you approved, that will go into effect June 1st, so you'd have them bump downwards there beginning in June.
Well, that September of 08, man, that was...
it was nasty.
Big gap.
Yeah.
Could you remind me again, this is always confusing to me, how this relates, not relate, but the bulk power cost adjustment, just wrote myself a note here. I mean, how is it's that rate in addition to we pay the bulk power cost adjustment? How's that figure in? Where's that number come from?
This is our retail rate here,
right.
The line in the red line.
Right.
So it includes the bulk power cost.
It does. Okay.
It does.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
The This is the last slide in the package, and we can cover this in quickly if you'd like, but these are some of the big things that my boss, Nick Goriello, is working on today. We have some excess capacity, like a lot of utilities in Florida and around the Southeast, and so we are looking to market some of that. All requirements of cities have said if it helps lower their cost to sell to other cities, that would be a good thing. We submitted a bid to the city of Quincy and won, and we're supplying power to them. We recently submitted a joint bid with Orlando Utilities Commission to supply power to Mount Dora, and so that's a competitive bid process, and we're waiting to hear on that. We've submitted in some other cities as well. And all the time through the Florida Municipal Power Pool, which is a group of municipal utilities, includes FMPA's All Requirements Project, Orlando Utilities Commission, and Lakeland Electric. We're all the time trying to market capacity on a daily and weekly basis to lower our costs. The Lake Worth settlement, the city of Lake Worth had filed a lawsuit against FMPA's All Requirements Project over natural gas transportation contract, but the good news is that we have come to a settlement with them. The Duke Progress merger, we're closely following that on behalf of our members, and it's been going on for a little while now. They made a recent filing that I think Progress Energy and Duke are hoping for a decision by July. We're actively monitoring that. We're also actively monitoring for our members the Crystal River Unit 3 plant outage. And we'll be working with Progress Energy to make sure the rights of our joint owners are protected. We're working with our member cities on what we call an internal gas hedging program called the GANT plan. It has not been approved yet, but this is just another way to try to manage the risks inherent in our natural gas portfolio. Our members are also discussing some governance changes. And we have a supermajority requirement for some types of decisions in our agency, and our members are looking at if they want to change the formula for the supermajority or not. And then finally, Gainesville Regional Utilities has come to us. They have some excess capacity in a biomass plant that they're building. It's a unit that'll burn wood chips, and they have some excess capacity. This is just a very new thing. We're gonna take a look at this as well.
I'm just gonna state for the record, we're down to below a quorum, so we can't have any more discussion among ourselves here just because of the sunshine law. Yeah. But I guess if
that was my last slide anyway.
That's what I thought. You were done. So we're not going to ask you any questions or talk to you anymore. Mayor Gwynn can, because he doesn't vote. But the rest of us are just sworn to see the silence here.
But not together.
That's true.
Thank you very much
for your
time and attention.
Thank you.
We really
appreciate your
opportunity
coming.
To be here.
Appreciate your traveling here. During the presentation, it was very informative and great history and how we got to where we are. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Did you have anything else?
Yeah. You want me to ask him some questions? And yell at us?
Yeah. No, he's going
to
say something.
Just kidding, Sue Carr, if you're listening to this.
Where is Sue when we need her?
No, I'm good. That was great. That was good information.
Very good.
Very good.
Do you have anything else?
No, but thank you.
Okay. Thank you both very much, and we're adjourned.
What time is that funeral on Thursday? I have a viewing from 6:30 to 7:00.
Yes.
First Baptist.
Yes, definitely. Hence the reason we always have puts on our balls now.
Yes. Have they?
Yes. That's true. We had the puts.